4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with nutritionist Christopher Gardner. Stay with us.
I'm Leslie Chang, and today my guest is Christopher Gardner. He is an associate professor in the School of Medicine as part of the Stanford Prevention Research Center, and his research focuses on diet and nutrition. So thank you for coming in today, Christopher.
Thanks for having me, Leslie.
So had you heard about the Anthropocene before I brought it up with you?
Not before you brought it up, and then I went straight to Google and I looked it up.
Okay, so what did Google tell you?
And Google and Wikipedia said that there's different periods in the history of the planet, and this one is when man may have changed life as we know it on Earth into this different period.
Right, at a global scale, right?
Global
human activity is really influencing the Earth at a global scale.
Uh-huh.
And so I think different people place the boundary of the Anthropocene at different times. You know, some say that it was at the Industrial Revolution or Agricultural Revolution, or they call it the Great Acceleration, when you start seeing all these graphs just increasing exponentially. I know you don't really know that much about the Anthropocene, but if you had to just kind of instinctively place the boundary somewhere, where might you place it?
So, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction would say that the Agricultural Revolution, which was centuries ago, was the big deal when we switched from hunter-gatherer to actually growing a lot of crops. But I have a feeling that didn't really change the makeup of the planet all that much, that we weren't polluting and killing off waterways and the atmosphere. It seems like it's when Earl Butz said we should plant fence row to fence row. So as part of a post-war approach to getting enough food to feed our soldiers and our people at home, to be really efficient, get big or get out. Take that farmland you've got and plant it fence row to fence row, which led to this abundance of corn in particular, more corn than we could eat, requiring us to find a use for the more corn, which ended up being fed to more livestock, which don't like eating corn, which we now have to hit with antibiotics and other things, mm-hmm. but made it possible for factory farms, which meant diversified farms got wiped out, and we have monocultures of corn and factory farms of livestock, and we've separated that natural symbiotic relationship where one takes care of the other. Now we have to truck all kinds of fertilizer into the monocultures. And for the factory farm, we have to take all the fertilizer away and spray it into the air or find different uses for it. So I would think it's the fence row to fence row post-war era.
So I'm going to have us change gears really quick. So how did you end up at Stanford?
Oh, it's a great story. I wanted to start a vegetarian restaurant a long time ago. Decided to take a couple of classes, so if I started my restaurant and people made fun of me, I'd have an articulate response. One thing led to another, and I had a PhD by mistake. And then I decided I'd be a teacher. Nobody gave me a teaching job. At the very last minute, the only job I got was a postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford. But it was all research, and I was really afraid that they would find out I wasn't really very good at research. I came on board and they were excellent mentors, and that was 1993. And so here I am in 2012, and I'm still here.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. So I looked you up a bit online, and I saw that you majored in philosophy for your undergrad and then ended up in nutritional science at Berkeley. Right?
Yes.
So how did you end up, you know, majoring in philosophy and then deciding that you wanted to start a vegetarian restaurant?
Oh, it's perfect. So when you major in philosophy, question all your values.
Uh-huh.
Once I became one, I realized it was very much more consistent with my personal values, philosophically speaking, than my previous McDonald's Burger King diet. And so I ended up sticking with a vegetarian diet and then ended up getting interested beyond ethics in health, which led me to back to school.
So I know for undergrad, you teach two classes. It's food and society. So you're teaching that this quarter.
Yes.
Right. And human nutrition next quarter. So what's it like to teach those two classes to undergrads? And, you know, what have you really learned through those two classes?
Oh, that's been fun. So let me start with the human nutrition because I've been doing that for 10 years. It's through human biology. It's an overview of nutrition. And by overview, the simplest way to describe that is it's proteins, carbs, and fats, vitamins, and minerals. Those are sort of the building blocks of nutrition. And since there's no nutrition program on campus, it's really just a really basic introductory level class. It's pretty easy to teach. So it was a nice overview of nutrition, and it always helped keep me updated every year. I'd have to sort of look one more time into all the vitamins and minerals and see if there was anything new that year that maybe was not an interest of mine personally, but had come up, the latest study. So the class helped me keep up to date, and the human biology students that I taught were fun. I'm mostly a researcher, so it was really fun to be involved with the undergrads and hear what kind of questions they had. So that went along really well for a number of years, and if anybody out there has seen my classes or participated, I have about 100, 120 slides per class. I just fly through PowerPoint slides and lots of information, lots of pictures. They're pretty fun. Apparently, my slides are well known for color, but moving to food and society, I have no slides. And so I am primarily a researcher. And in all the research I've done for the last 15 years, I have to say I've started to become dissatisfied with my own work. My own work is very health-oriented. Does garlic lower cholesterol? Does fish oil lower triglycerides? Does calcium make your bones stronger? Should you be on a low-carb or a low-fat diet to lose weight? Those are all questions that the public has, and I feel like be great to be in a role where I help them resolve those questions. So I've designed and got funded a lot of NIH studies, and we've tested some of these things. But in the long run, I started to feel like, why am I doing these studies? The ones that are working, people aren't following the advice, and the ones that aren't working, they're going to do it anyway?
Yeah.
So about this time, a lot of the emphasis out there wasn't so much on what would lower your cholesterol or blood pressure, but weight issues. Obesity has really risen to the fore as the biggest public health challenge out there. And about this time, the NIH put out a request for applications for novel ways to help young adults. And the emphasis of this was intended to target the population that puts on weight the fastest. So young adults happen to be the segment of the population.
So what age range would that be?
So like 18 to 30 or 18 to 40 or something like that.
Okay.
Right? I'd say 18 to 30. So they wanted some novel approaches to weight loss, novel and innovative. And it was about this time that I had been participating in, attending a speaker film series on this campus that was called The Ethics of Food and the Environment.
Yeah, that's a great series.
So I was just stunned how packed the venues were at those events. I thought, wait, hasn't anybody read my article in the Journal of the American Medical Association? Don't you know all the health? Oh, you're more interested in the ethics or the human labor abuses or, the global warming. So I saw them all getting interested in this, and my colleague and I, Tom Robinson, decided we would put together this grant application with the theme being social responsibility and engagement, and that would be our novel approach, and that we would get young adults more interested than they had been before in eating well by getting them engaged and feeling socially responsible. So when we finished writing this grant and we submitted it, Tom, who's smarter than I am, he said, you know what, that was a really good exercise writing that up, but we're not going to get that funded. There's no pilot data. This kind of thing really needs some pilot data to get funded, and we don't have any. It might be a great idea, but it'll be too risky. I said, we worked all that time. How frustrating. What could we do? And he said, well, let me think. I guess we could have a class. I said, a class? Sure, I guess so, maybe. Why not? All right. A week later, he had applied for and got a class approved. And the class is called Food and Society. And so really, we borrowed most of the films and the books that Deborah Satz had included in the speaker film series, and we exposed the students to those. And very interestingly, we never talked about health, or that was certainly never the focus.
Not a single time?
Talked about animal rights, animal welfare, global warming, fast food, business practices, economics.
Really? So wait, so let me get this straight. So you, as a researcher who do research on diet and nutrition at the School of Medicine and this class that you're teaching, does not take that health approach at all?
Nope. There's no health in it. It's all the other angles.
And do you think that's effective for the students?
Well, it's been intoxicating to watch what happens in this class. So yes, within weeks, almost every student is considering changing their diet because of what they've read about that. If we give them the transparency for the food system and say, here's really where your food comes from, can you live with that? No, that's horrible. Oh my gosh, I'm perpetuating this. I have to find some other way out of this. And here's what's especially fun for me. So for one person, for example, they'll read about animal rights and welfare, and they'll say, you know, now that you've pointed this out to me, oh, I can't even bear the thought of looking at that livestock in the eye and eating it. It got treated so miserably. I'm going to eat less fast food, less meat. I just can't do it that way. And right across from a student says, you know, I grew up on a farm. It's not like that. We treated our cattle really well, and, you know, I just don't buy that. If we weren't going to eat them, we wouldn't raise them, and so it's not an animal rights or welfare issue. But that global warming talk we had the other day, oh, I had no idea that the big factory farms are causing that much. They're contributing to greenhouse gases and the methane and the, oh, my gosh. Now I'm going to have to change the way I eat and cut back on meat and have more locally sustained meat because I'm horrified at what it does to the global warming. And then the student next to them will say, you know, guys, I don't get either of those. But, you know, I'm really into local economy, local sustainable, support your farms. And I really think that we ought to start supporting the local farmers, more local business, not so much exporting overseas and sending our food away. And yet a last one will say, fourth student will say, you know, it's the human labor abuses that get me. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm only going to buy fair trade now. Now that you've explained the whole banana, chocolate, coffee, child slave labor thing, it's like the Nike shoes. Oh my gosh, I've got to respond to this. I'm going to change the way I eat because of human rights. And so it's been very interesting that it's a different hook for different people. And if you only have one hook, you can't grab many of these people. But if you have multiple tools in your tool chest, it seems to be much more effective. And most of them lead, interestingly, to the same place. If you follow them through till their logical conclusion, it's less meat, less packaged processed food, more vegetables, more local, seasonable food.
You know, in the past couple of years, the food movement, sustainable agriculture, all of this has gained a lot of traction. And especially at Stanford, I think a lot of students are starting to become really more aware of these issues. So do you teach the class differently every year? Do you have new readings or, you know, what have you learned from teaching that class?
Yes, it's a great question. We always have to update it. And somebody's always coming up each year with another book that we're interested in trying out. So, for example, on the ethics side, one of the best writers in the field of ethics is a guy named Peter Singer. And so for a couple of years, we had Peter Singer's books. And then most recently, I guess we've had it for 2 years now, Jonathan Safran Foer wrote a book called Eating Animals.
It's a great book.
Oh, you've read it.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
But think about who Jonathan Safran Foer is. The other stuff he's done is Everything is Illuminated, which turned into a major film. And I just read that one of his other books that's not nutrition-oriented at all is getting turned into a film.
Yeah, I think it's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Yes.
He's actually one of my favorite authors, so I've read both of those books and Eating Animals. It's interesting because he's a fiction writer most of the time.
Exactly. And so these folks are better writers. Michael Pollan is a great writer. Barbara Kingsolver wrote a book called Animal, Vegetable, Miracle. And, you know, in the past we've had health educators writing scientific material about public health. And to be honest, we're not good writers. We're not captivating. We're not engaging. There's a lot of may. If you do this, it may do this over that period of time. If you happen to do this and there isn't the confounding of which I can't be entirely sure because a randomized controlled trial has not yet been designed to answer that exact question. Mm-hmm. But these writers, they just get out there and they hook you with the language and the parallels they draw. They're just really effective at describing things in ways that hook people and grab their attention. So we switched from Peter Singer, who's not a bad writer, but Jonathan Safran Foer's book is more captivating. We clearly saw it in that year's class. Now, kind of the opposite, we still haven't quite found the writer that's been able to capture global warming. So we had a really nice book that a local chef, Laura Steck, wrote about my global diet. I'm forgetting the name at the moment. Sorry, Laura, if you're listening to this. And she did it in conjunction with a scientist. She's a chef and he's a scientist. And it was pretty well received, but not great. And then Francis Moore LePay, who 40 years ago wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet, which turned many people into vegetarians 40 years ago. She has a daughter, and her daughter wrote the follow-up book, Diet for a Hot Planet Instead of a Small Planet. And Anna wrote about all the connections to global warming. And it was good, but a lot of the students were frustrated, and just with the writing style, especially after reading Jonathan Safran Foer and Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation. So whenever we find this new book or a new hook or a new approach, we try to include those.
So I looked up some numbers, actually, right before this interview on obesity in the United States. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's about a third of all American adults now are obese. Does that sound about right?
Perfect. 35%.
That's really, really incredible. Do you have a good sense of how many years that statistic has been in the making?
Oh, just 20 or 30.
20 or 30. So yeah. What are, you know, the biggest changes that have happened in the American food industry that have kind of, you know, pushed this along? Is it because of marketing issues? Does it come down to personal choice? Like, where do we kind of draw those lines?
So it's probably a number of different factors. One of the factors being food's available 24/7 now. All over the place. So vending machines, takeout, drive-thrus are open longer. It's certainly easier to get food. And culturally, we've moved from three meals a day and maybe a snack to grazing all day long. So the food industry is, you know, microwaving, et cetera. Everything's just made it so convenient and tasty. So the food industry has figured out ways to layer salt and fat and sugar on top of one another in really complex combinations that almost make it impossible to tell you're full. It's so tasty. You put another one and another one and another one in your mouth. But as an overarching issue to all this, it actually points to one thing that we've done a little bit wrong. So as we, around the 1950s, there was a nutritional transition. And that had been before the 1950s, we had nutritional deficiencies that were important. Pellagra and beriberi and some diseases that you haven't even heard of because they're gone now. It's because you were deficient in thiamine or riboflavin or niacin, and those are all gone. And once we eliminated those, what we got instead was heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. And so the people were struck by a couple of possibilities. One that it was, oh, it's the fat. We're putting on all these calories in our body from the fat that we're getting. So we need to go on this big low-fat public health mantra. And so we pushed low-fat, low-fat, low-fat. And in the process of doing that, the food industry responded, and they added sugar to a whole bunch of packaged, processed, low-fat food. And so I actually believe that a lot of added sugar had undermined that whole low-fat effort. And low-fat could have been, oh, carrots are low-fat, eggplants low-fat, red bell peppers, squash are low-fat. But so is a low-fat cookie that's got low-fat chocolate chips that's made with all kinds of sugar and high-fructose corn syrup. So if you look at the trend data since the 70s, what you'll see is in the U.S., the grams of fat have stayed relatively the same. Grams of carbohydrate per day have gone up. And so the percentage of fat has gone down, but the amount of fat hasn't gone up. So the amount of carbohydrate has gone up. And of that, about half of it is actually due just to beverages, added sugar beverages.
It's those sodas and juices.
Yeah. I mean, and first, you know, the first step there was the 6-ounce Coke that became 12, that became 20, that became 24, that became 48, and not really realizing how many calories that was. But then there's Arizona Tea and Rockstar and Red Bull. And if you look at all those drinks that people are consuming, they're full of sugar, and beverages are not particularly satiating. People have done studies where they say, okay, here's a set amount of food, and one's going to have a soda with sugar in it, and one's going to have water. Okay, now let's see what happens to the food you eat. And they eat roughly the same amount of food.
Oh,
they're filled up with the same amount of food, and the beverage is just kind of extra. And it's not as if, oh, I had the food and a Coke, and so I'm full, so I'm going to have less food. You don't, really. You eat the same amount of food, and you drink the Coke. So this added sugar beverage is probably an important piece of the puzzle. The added sugar in low-fat foods that people that thought they had license to get. Oh, I'm getting something healthful because it says low fat. I won't really look too closely at the ingredients, which happen to be a lot of calories because this thing's full of sugar that it never had before. That's probably another part of the puzzle. And the other one is the one I started with, is that food's just available everywhere all the time. Students can appreciate late night food, right? There's a lot of food available late night.
Yeah, definitely.
More than some need.
Absolutely.
To stay awake.
So I've heard that you eat an 80% local sustainable diet and 20% to have fun. So what does that 80% look like? And then what's that other 20%?
So I got that from Jesse Cool, who I'm a huge fan of Jesse Cool. So for those of your listeners who don't know this, she's the one who runs the Cool Cafe in Cantor Museum. And she's got Flea Street Cafe, which is a really upscale restaurant in Atherton. And she's had a number of other ventures. And I can't take credit for that line. That's Jesse's line. So my 80% rule includes on Saturday mornings, there's a German bakery, Esther's Bakery, and she makes these fabulous chocolate pastry horseshoe things that I have almost religiously every Saturday for breakfast. And this, there's some kind of fruit pastry as well. And there's another square that has almonds in it and chocolate around the edges. So Saturday morning, I have pastries.
That's part of the 20%?
That's part of the 20%. Let's see, what else would be part? I'm a chocolate chocoholic, so I go to the California Farmers Market for the Barvalento uber great chocolate, and I get about, I don't know how many, it's too embarrassing to say how much chocolate I buy. So I have a couple pieces of chocolate every day. Let's see, what else? The other day, I'm moving more toward vegan, but the other day, the whole family wanted Pizza Chicago Dillinger pizza, which is a vegetarian pizza, but it's got cheese on it, and it's got a white crust flour, and it's really tasty. And so we ordered a pizza, and so I had two slices of pizza.
So what about, you know, sustainably produced meat or eggs that come from a diversified, sustainable, small organic farm? How do you feel about those? You know, is it for you better to just cut them completely out of your diet, or would it be good for some people to incorporate those into their diet so that they do support those people who are trying to, you know, raise meat sustainably and in a fair way?
Yeah, I would be a strong proponent of people eating well, including animals and livestock that were raised sustainably with proper animal husbandry and supporting local farmers. I really don't expect the world to go vegetarian anytime soon. But along the pathway of eating better or worse, the smaller local farms, for all kinds of reasons that we bring up in our class, are going to be better. Animal rights, animal welfare, human labor issues, environmentally, global warmingly. So I'm very supportive of that. In fact, and this will make me stray from my vegan diet for sure, we got 5 chicks 3 weeks ago. And dang, they are huge now. Just 3 weeks later, they're all laying hens. I built a chicken coop in the backyard. And I can't imagine we're going to eat these chickens. I've heard that laying hens actually don't taste very good anyway. But I have several friends with chickens. And I don't have a huge backyard, but we've planted a bunch of things. And my littlest boys love running around the backyard, picking things fresh and eating it. And I would like them to see that eggs come from chickens, and what chickens look like, and what happy chickens look like that are expressing their chickenness in our backyard chicken coop. In class, we talk about some really innovative, interesting, diversified farmers who are trying to bring back the honor and the respect that the innovative, intellectually inspired farmer has, you have to be really clever to grow food under all kinds of conditions, unless you're going to do the monoculture thing with this massive piece of tractor that you just drive back and forth on the field. So in class all the time, we read about some of the really interesting folks. I guess the key word here, and you used it too, diversified farms. So, you know, if you go to these factory farms where everything's wrong, they've taken this elegant solution and made two problems out of it. So now they've got all this manure to deal with and no place to put it because they're not growing any produce there. And it's just accumulating. Whereas if you're on the farm, I totally buy this idea that in proper animal husbandry, the livestock are fertilizing the ground. And then you're growing plants in the ground. And some of the plants you feed to humans and some of them you feed back to the livestock. And it's a cycle. And if the farmers have diversified livestock and diversified plants or produce and even forest, I've heard even forest is important to have in this diversified situation, then everything thrives and it's more resilient to all kinds of insults from nature, which we've destroyed when we go to monocultures of corn and when we go to these factory farms.
Right. So you said, you know, there's a lot of these school-based gardening programs coming up in California. And I think, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, and so, and now I go to Stanford, and so I've been here my whole life. So how do we get this to spread to other states who might not be as receptive to programs like this?
Well, part of it is you have to build some successful models that you can disseminate. And I guess this may sound a little unfair, but it really is easier to do it in California, not only with our natural weather climate, but also our political climate, or people who are people in the San Francisco Bay Area who are willing to be spark plugs and push something like this and be innovators. A lot of times these things fail. They're not sustainable. It takes too much energy. It takes too much time. It takes too much money. But that often happens when you're starting something new and you haven't figured out the most efficient way to do it. Let me give the example of this Full Circle Farm. The community, there was this 11-acre plot of land lying fallow. It had been a high school that got downsized to a middle school. And so the middle school didn't need the football field or the soccer field. They just needed a playground. So there's all this land lying around. And the community voted between a soccer complex and condominiums, both of which would have brought lots of money into the community, or an 11-acre organic farm, which is going to bring no money to the community, but would be a community resource. And bless their hearts, the community voted for the farm over the condominiums and the soccer complex. And to be honest, they've struggled. They're in their fourth year. Lots of energy and enthusiasm. It's not a high-paying job. It's a lot of hard work. The ground they had to work with was baked and dry, so they've had to dig it up. It's only 11 acres, so you can't really afford this massive tractor. In fact, what's more efficient is having a corporate team-building day and have 1,000 people come from some corporation come out and dig up a whole row. And so they've been really innovative in terms of how they've used the 11 acres, and they're trying to build up the fertility of the soil in an organic way, not with the pesticides that the monoculture approach types use or the fertilizers that they try to use. They've struggled. They're still there 4 years later. In fact, I think they're pretty much ready to turn the corner and be sustainable. At some point, they will grow enough vegetables and produce and fruit. They just planted 350 fruit trees, but they're not at full fruition yet. At some point, when they sell all this through their CSA, their community-supported agriculture, or at their farm stand, or to restaurants, it's going to be enough to pay for the wages of all the staff and all the input that go into the farm. But so far, they've lived a lot on donations. And unless they get more and more donations, they'll go under. So to me, that's an example of, wow, here's this incredibly innovative, semi-urban, bio-intensive farming project. And if they had all the lessons learned packaged up for somebody, they could say, oh, you know, don't do this. We did this wrong. We almost went under. And don't do this either. We thought that was the right path. But now that we've put it all together, you could scale this up or down, and we could replicate this, and we could try this somewhere else because we have a lot of lessons to share. So I'm really hoping that California is an incubator of those kinds of ideas where we work out some of the kinks so that we can go to Missouri or New England or North Dakota, and there'll be other challenges there. There's another set of climate conditions to deal with. But a lot of those could be incubated here to get them started.
It seems like the food industry is really huge. Are you optimistic about the future?
I'm really optimistic, partly because of the internet and transparency and the new writers that we have. Because of the Jonathan Safran Foers and the Michael Pollans, the Marion Nestles, the Peter Singers, the Eric Schlossers, Barbara King Solvers, and partly because of the obesity epidemic, which is more visual than before. So for decades, our poor dietary habits have been wreaking havoc with chronic diseases of heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. But heart disease and cancer are hard to see immediately. Those are decades in the future. But when you see obese 10-year-old children who are being signed up for bariatric surgery or liposuction, you think something is really wrong here. And then when you have a downer cow on the internet go viral, that somebody caught on film a forklift shoving this probably diseased cow into a slaughterhouse just to make sure they got every last little scrap of meat out of that thing, and people are revolted. So I guess I'm excited and optimistic right now because farmers markets have doubled and this topic is more and more being brought up. You're podcasting about it. This will probably change the whole world right here that you're having this podcast. Thanks for having this.
Of course.
There's a greater interest. I think more of those solutions are becoming available and it's resonating with more people, and there's different, we're framing the issue more effectively and it's catching on. So I'm really excited.
Well, thank you for joining me here today, Christopher. I really appreciate it.
This is a fun conversation, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?